supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Let's start this evening with an update on a now notorious stretch of railroad track in Philadelphia that's become a haven for heroin users. Conrail is due to begin cleanup on the tracks next week, and neighbors are hopeful it will bring some relief from the rampant drug use plaguing the area. Though the project will displace some 75 homeless heroin users who camp in the railroad gulch, and many more who go there to shoot up. City officials are trying to help as many of them as they can before they move their habit around to other places in the neighborhood. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram reports that some say those efforts are falling short.
Dominic Tabarelli's house on Tusculum Street faces ground zero of Philadelphia's heroin epidemic. His view of the Conrail tracks is blocked by overgrown weeds and bushes on the slope leading down there, but he says he doesn't have to be able to see the encampment along the tracks to witness the trauma of heroin addiction. Police carry the limp bodies of overdose victims up the slope on a routine basis.
They just had one 2 days yesterday, matter of fact, on the corner where the bridge is at. They found him overdosed. They pulled him up. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning.
The city reports that 17 people died of overdoses around the tracks last year, and another 29 were rescued by emergency responders. Tabarelli is 43 and was raised in this house, where he lives with his wife and three sons. He says he's had to deal with the hazards of living alongside a haven for heroin use for more than 30 years.
I tell my kids all the time, I tell my wife all the time, I tell everybody, watch, don't go outside the house without no shoes on. There's needles through the whole entire block.
Tabarelli hopes that a coordinated effort by the city and Conrail to clear out the encampment will finally bring peace to his block. The railroad will clean up tons of tires and debris, remove hundreds of thousands of dirty needles, and cut down vegetation that hides drug activities along the half-mile stretch of tracks. It's currently installing new fencing to make sure people don't return once the work is done. But the homeless people struggling with heroin addiction will have to go somewhere once the work begins. Many people worry that they'll spread out to other pockets of a neighborhood that's already known for being an open-air drug market.
While we do this cleanup and we bring out of the element something that for a long time has been contained, it's going to be more disruptive.
That's City Councilwoman Maria Quiñones-Sanchez, whose district includes the heroin encampment. When city officials announced the cleanup plan with Conrail last month, they promised to address the human side of the project. They've set up a 23-bed emergency shelter at Prevention Point, Philadelphia, and have 35 permanent housing slots reserved for people coming from the area. Addiction treatment teams also ramped up outreach around the Conrail tracks to offer services. The Office of Homeless Services says it counted 78 people living in the camp at the beginning of May. They've counted fewer people more recently as word spreads about the cleanup, but as of the end of June, only 9 people have accepted help from outreach workers. These numbers worry advocates like Prevention Point's executive director, Jose Benitez. He says that the new resources won't be enough and that barriers in the city's treatment system make it difficult to serve people who are interested in getting help.
We just don't have capacity. There's not enough beds or treatment slots to be able to handle the folks that are going to come out of there. Those are 75 people, we think, that are homeless, that we're evicting from their homes.
I spoke with Benitez at a town hall meeting in Kensington. Fans are running on full blast on a hot and sticky evening in a building that used to be a church. People pack the pews for a dialogue on the opioid crisis with city representatives.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Many of them eagerly line up for a chance to comment on a presentation about the city's response to the crisis. One commenter asks about a shortage of slots for medication-assisted treatment, which uses drugs including methadone or Vivitrol to manage cravings and withdrawal symptoms. While the city estimates there are about 70,000 heroin users in Philadelphia, it provides only about 7,000 slots for medication-assisted treatment. Overall, the city's publicly funded system treated about 14,000 people for opioid addiction last year. Luke Patrick Dunn, who is in recovery, says some people are discouraged from seeking help because it can take too long to get started on treatment. He went into withdrawal when he first went to an intake center to sign up.
You can get hung up in one of those places for like 2 to 3 days, and you give up, like, because you get sick, you know, and you just give up. I mean, I've experienced that.
Dunn was homeless in Kensington before landing a slot 15 months ago in a program called Journey of Hope. He says the long-term housing provided by the program has allowed him to get back on his feet. He's about to move into an apartment of his own and has a job doing outreach for Prevention Point. I meet another peer outreach worker who's been going down to meet with people at the Conrail encampment. Ramon Cruz Jr. says the problem for most of them isn't accessing treatment, it's getting stable housing to keep them in recovery.
They have been getting treatment, but then they come back out, they have no housing. So they go back to what they know best. And it's a continual cycle.
Cruz lives in Kensington and says you can already see drug users migrating to new spots as Conrail puts up fencing.
We have people that are under that bridge at Emerald Street. We have people that are under the bridge on near Aramingo.
The city says it will find more treatment beds for people from the camp if it reaches capacity. But many aren't yet willing to accept help. Prevention Point's Benitez says that more people at the Conrail tracks might be motivated for change once cleanup work begins and heavy machinery moves into the area.
But I also caution that there are always going to be people that are not ready for the services that we have to offer them.
He says it takes time to earn their trust. Ultimately, he says, that trust will depend on whether those offering treatment can follow through on their promises. For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Since 2014, the city of Philadelphia has been dealing with a lawsuit over its controversial civil asset forfeiture program. Now, city officials are offering to take big steps to reform the practice. Though, as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the advocacy group that brought the suit says the city's still not going far enough.
Civil asset forfeiture is when police take someone's property, car, or cash based on the suspicion that the person is linked to a crime. This happens without filing any charges. When the seized assets are sold, authorities use the proceeds to fund the police department and the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Lawyers who filed the suit found it amounted to 20% of the DA's budget. The lawsuit against the city says this creates an illegal and perverse incentive.
Ask anyone, oh, did you know that the police in the city keep forfeiture proceeds and they're the ones that, you know, decide whether to seize the property? It's common sense that, of course, that's some kind of conflict of interest.
Darpana Sheth is with the Institute for Justice, the public interest law firm that brought the suit. Recently, the city proposed a major change. It would use forfeiture proceeds for drug treatment programs, not paying the salaries and overtime for police and DAs.
Sure, you know, the court should definitely enjoin this practice going forward. We don't oppose that. But we do oppose the idea that that is the end and resolves this claim entirely.
So why is Sheth still unhappy? Because she wants the city to admit that it violated the rights of people whose property was seized. City lawyers wouldn't agree to an interview, but in a recent court filing, they said they used a valid state law and never stomped on anyone's rights. Sheth says she will fight to get the city to admit wrongdoing. If there's a court order saying the city was at fault, it would allow thousands of Philadelphians to sue for damages. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
Since its inception in 1925, New Yorker magazine has published some 70,000 cartoons featuring the likes of Charles Adams, George Booth, Saul Steinberg, James Thurber, among countless acclaimed contributors. Not included in that cohort are the cartooning team of illustrator Derek Stukels and captioner Yannis Chakars. Undeterred, despite submitting 94 cartoons for consideration, the duo have published a thin tome entitled No Love for the Penguin, Cartoons Rejected by the New Yorker. As a consolation for falling short of the broader goal, Yannis Chakars, assistant professor in communications at Gwynedd Mercy University, joins me on Newsworks Tonight. Yannis, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is a book of rejection as well as celebration. Describe the process of submitting a cartoon to the acclaimed New Yorker.
Well, we did it. Well, we didn't know it at the time, but it was in the manner that New Yorker cartoons were originally composed. That is, the illustrator and the caption writer were separate people. And so I would write a caption, and I would simply text it to Derek Stuckels, my collaborator. And it was his task to then make it funny, because it's really the image that makes it funny. So he would try to make it funny. We would collect a batch. He had heard that the New Yorker prefers a batch of cartoons as opposed to one at a time. They want to see that you can be a cartoonist, not just make one good cartoon. So once we had 5 or 10, then we would send them down to the New Yorker, and we would wait and wait and wait. And the mode of rejection was the most time-honored one of all, silence.
Now, Robert Mankoff has served as cartoon editor at the magazine since 1998. He's edited more than a dozen collections, and often in that collection, he'll offer tips or methods used to select cartoons. Did you use that as kind of a primer to help game the system?
We actually did not, but Derek had an inside guy. He had a friend that had worked for The New Yorker, so he gave us some tips, which we tried to follow and generally did not help.
Now, in terms of submitting collections, is that why this book is All Things Penguin?
Derek started drawing penguins, and he created a little like Tumblr site called Sayeth Penguin, where he would you'd draw a penguin, and the penguin would be in a speech bubble, give a sort of aphorism or some other pronouncement. I think this was like October 2012, and I remember an early one that I liked, just like a penguin slipping, and he just said like, "Oh lordy." And so the penguin wasn't really going anywhere, so he called me and he said, "Hey, how about we try something new with this penguin that I've been drawing? Why don't you write me captions and we'll send them to the New Yorker?" And so that's how it started.
And again, this is how it was originally done in the early days, to have a team rather than a combined illustrator captioner.
Yeah, and as I understand it, the team wasn't always like a permanent team, but the captioner and the illustrator were separate people.
And so when you're left with 94 lemons, let's call them, how do you make lemonade?
Well, that was the idea of the book. You know, they were sitting around and we hadn't done anything with them. And Derek and I were old punk rockers. And one thing you learn from punk rock, actually, is that when you're rejected by an existing community, which you almost by definition are, is you just go and make your own stuff. And you go and make your own community. And you derive joy from doing it yourself. So we decided just to return to our roots and do it ourselves and say, "Be damned, New Yorker. We don't need you. We can make our own scene. We'll make our own little penguin cartoon scene."
Describe your Lennon-McCartney process with your co-collaborator. Who comes to who first? Do you have a caption and say, "Give me the image," vice versa, some of each?
99% of the time it's me with the caption, and I'll send it to him. And I'll often assume that he'll get the context, although he didn't always.
But he typically does.
But he typically does because, you know, it'll be something, you know, in the air at the time, you know. So like when we did these cartoons, it was around the time of the Pope changeover. So there's like some Pope jokes in there and it'll be obvious to him. But a number of times he didn't. And he would draw a picture or create a picture that like changed the meaning of what I intended. But that was kind of delightful to me, you know, like that he took his own read on it and that he made something new.
And that there was enough ambiguity and play in the words to represent them in a different way than perhaps you imagined initially.
Yeah, and that's one of the fun things about images, about cartoons, is what the viewer brings to it.
The Slender book is entitled No Love for the Penguin, Cartoons Rejected by the New Yorker. We've been talking to captioner Yannis Tsakkaris, assistant professor in communications at Gwinnett Mercy University. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Yannis, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you so much.
Over the weekend, three people were shot in Chester. Two of them died. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that despite beefing up police patrols, the city is on track this year to see its highest number of homicides in a decade.
For years, Chester has had a homicide rate earning it a spot near the top of the list of America's most dangerous cities. This year, Police Chief James Nolan says the city, about 20 miles south of Philadelphia, has had more fatalities than usual.
Oh, it certainly is higher than normal. This time in 2015 and 16, we were at 12. We're currently at 20.
Violent crime has risen 11% nationwide after declining for decades. But Chester's history is unique. Against the backdrop of generally high violent crime, the city's police department has been the target of budget cuts. Now, Nolan says the department is working with fewer officers after a rash of retirements.
We're at about 85 total. We're budgeted for 106.
In May, Delaware County ponied up $100,000 to bring in the Pennsylvania State Police, adding extra manpower for patrols through the fall. But former Mayor John Linder says he's not surprised that hasn't led to a decrease in shooting deaths.
It's typically cyclical and the territorial disputes that go on. And in the summertime, that can tend to be really out of hand.
Linder held office in 2014, a year when the city saw 30 homicides, the highest number in the last decade. The city could surpass that number this year. He and Chief Nolan say it's hard to get witnesses to cooperate in Chester, a small city where everyone knows everyone. So Nolan is focused on recovering illegal firearms, more than 80 in 2017, although he says there's no way to count how many crimes that could prevent. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
The New Horizons spacecraft left planet Earth in January 2006, and it's right on target to reach its next destination of note on New Year's Day, 2019. Let's check its progress with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, this is quite the journey.
I'd say it's quite the journey. You know, it was more than 3 billion miles from Earth out to Pluto to begin with. And to get to its next destination, an asteroid found fairly far out in what's called the Kuiper Belt, it's going to be another billion miles from Pluto to reach what's known as MU69.
How large is MU69?
Well, that's a great question. We're not really sure exactly how large it is. It's on the smaller side. It's a few tens of miles across. But astronomers aren't really certain about a lot of things about MU69, and there have been some efforts recently to try to define the parameters a little bit better.
Why was it then selected as a target? Is it one of the larger asteroids in that region?
It's not that it's one of the larger asteroids, but it is that it's an object that can tell us an awful lot about the early history of the solar system.
Not to get past ourselves, but are there destinations of note already lined up beyond MU69?
Not already lined up, but the spacecraft is still in good condition and could certainly continue on to another destination after that.
Still in communications with us?
Absolutely still in communication, still delivering data from Pluto. What's going to happen next for this spacecraft during its cruise out to MU69 is it's going to get a chance to take a break. Operators are going to shut the spacecraft down into a slumber stage and just let it sleep for most of its trip out to MU69. It's a well-deserved rest.
On this date in 1969, three heroes returned to planet Earth.
The Apollo 11 mission came to an end on this date in 1969. The astronauts had been out to the moon and back. And they were only outside on the surface for about 2.5 hours, and that was Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, who skipped around on the surface. They were very careful not to go too far away from the spacecraft while they were on the surface. And in fact, even before Aldrin got out of the lunar module to step out onto the surface, Neil Armstrong had been down on the surface of the moon for a few minutes and collected some rocks that he put into a sample bag that he then put into his thigh pocket on the exterior of his spacesuit, just in case, for whatever reason, they'd have to suddenly take off under emergency, he would have some rock samples to bring back to Earth.
Certainly not too soon to note that we are now merely 1 month out from a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity here in the United States.
This is the total solar eclipse that's going to take place on Monday, August 21st. Now, it won't be a total eclipse for those of us living in the northeastern portion of the United States, but you can get to a location where totality is visible. South Carolina is the closest state, a mere 12-hour drive.
How long is the show?
It can run for up to 3.5 hours, depending where you are. Totality, though, for this particular eclipse maxes out at about 2 minutes 40 seconds.
Arguably less awe-inspiring, but no less noteworthy, what's available to be seen in the night sky in our region this week.
As it turns out, this is a great week to follow the developing phases of our moon. If we start watching tonight, there's a barely visible 1.5-day-old thin crescent that's following just behind the sun. As you watch its progression, by Friday, it will be just above Jupiter at 8:30, and the other part is that on Saturday, it grows to a first quarter moon. Now, if you happen to catch it tonight or tomorrow night, one of the great things you'll be able to see is this phenomenon called Earthshine. As you look at the moon, you'll see the thinly illuminated crescent, but then just behind the crescent, you'll be able to see the sort of shadowy, silhouetted version, if you will, of the rest of the moon. Well, you can see the rest of the surface of the moon because sunlight reflecting up from Earth throws some light onto that portion of the moon that isn't illuminated directly by the sun and allows us to see the full remaining shape of the moon.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Fitz, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. The Eagles are reporting to training camp starting this week, and what are the prospects for Carson Wentz and the Birds in the quarterback's second year? We'll talk pigskin with Daily News columnist Marcus Hayes on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.